Well, we're in chapter 11, verse 2. We get to the angelic messenger's revelation. Here's what he had to say. This section represents the concluding revelation given to Daniel and follows directly Daniel's vision received in the previous chapter. One of these happened right after the other. The revelation gives a history of key events leading up to the end times that affect the nation of Israel. So it's an Israel-centered prophecy. He begins with Daniel's own time, makes reference to four Persian kings. He moves on to the Greek period, beginning with Alexander the Great, continuing through the division of his empire into four kingdoms. Two of these kingdoms have special significance because of the relationship to the Jews in Palestine. Following this, the angel more fully develops the activities of Antiochus IV, who took the name Epiphanes, the Glorious. You want to think about that. If you decide to call yourself the Glorious, make sure there's a reason. But the one whose persecution of the Jews foreshadows the activities of the future Antichrist. And then he moves from Antiochus to the actual future Antichrist, giving a description of Antichrist's reign of terror in the end times. And the section ends with the promise of future deliverance and blessing for the saints. So this is a powerhouse of prophecy. And it's, if somebody just told you that here at this time, Daniel received a message that detailed this kind of history, you would just be shocked. And it's been really this passage and one before that caused the liberals to say, this can't be. So it had to be written much later after all these events happened. The prophecy was so literally fulfilled that it reads like a history after the fact. So number one, verses 2-4, the prophecies concerning Persia and Greece. Here's what the passage says. And now, the angel says, will I show thee the truth. Behold, there shall stand up yet three kings in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than they all. And by his strength through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Grisha. A mighty king shall stand up that shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. And when he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken and shall be divided toward the four winds of heaven, and not to his posterity, nor according to his dominion which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be plucked up, even for others besides those. This is a rather detailed description. The angel says three more kings would arise in Persia. Since Cyrus was the first, the three kings that were to follow were his successors, Cambyses, 530-522, Smerdis, also known as Gaumata, 522, Darius the first, Hystaspes, can't remember what Hystaspes means. You remember, Jeff? Yeah, one of those added names, 522-486. Subsequent to these, a fourth king would arise who would amass great wealth and arouse the entire empire against the Greeks. The fourth king was Xerxes the first, 486-465. This is the Ahasuerus of the Book of Esther. The name change is confusing to us. Different people have different ideas why he's called Ahasuerus and Xerxes and so on, but that's identifying the same man. He was known both for his wealth and for his unsuccessful efforts to avenge his father's earlier defeat by the Greeks. The angel reveals he shall stir up all against the realm of Grisha. In fact, the beginning of the book of Esther, we find that he's having wife trouble. He's trying to rally the troops to go go out to battle. It's my opinion, it doesn't spell it out in the Bible there, but it's my opinion that he at the time, and I learned this from the encyclopedia, he had two palaces. There was the new one. He was a budding architect and planner and stuff. So he had a new palace built for himself. But he had the army leaders meet with him in the old palace, which was his father's. His father had been killed by the Greeks. So you think of the tradition he was stirring up. You know, here we meet back, my murdered father's palace. And I think what he wanted is to put a face to the homeland as they go out to battle. And it's my opinion he asked Queen Vashti to come and read these things that people are saying he was asking her to be immoral or something. That could be, I don't know. It doesn't say that. But I think he wanted the beautiful queen to be one of their last views there in the old historic palace when they go out, you know, to fight for king and queen and country. At any rate, she refused to come. Not going to do it. Talk to the hand. And so now he says, great, this really shows my strength of leadership, you know. Can't even control my wife. And he gets counsel and they say, you need to put her away and get a new wife. So they begin a kind of a Miss America contest to see who gets to be the next wife. Not queen for a day, but queen for the rest of your life. There's a contest. So it'd be on, you know, Fox Network today, the reality show, Choosing the Queen. At any rate, Esther got chosen, and it was this, and so he goes off to war, but then he comes back, but was not successful. He is considered to be petulant, pouty. The story in the encyclopedia is that he came to a river, and they started building some sort of bridge across it. A storm came up, and the river water washed it away. He was so furious, he ordered the river whipped. That'll show it. This is, you remember that when she took it into her life in her hands to go visit him without being called. This is the guy she was going to visit. All right. story here of Persia ends with Ahasuerus. So he ignored the remaining Persian kings and pictures a mighty king. The prophecy now leaps over 150 years of Medo-Persian history to Alexander the Great. He, Alexander, defeated the Medo-Persians and expanded the Greek Empire throughout much of the Eastern Hemisphere. Previously, Alexander was depicted, chapter 7, verse 6, as a leopard, and in 8, 5 to 7, as the conspicuous horn on the male goat who trampled down the ram. This king would die at the height of his strength. By the way, it's been interesting to me to find in modern times that the main biographer of Alexander had a motive to show that he was no good. And so if you've all heard the story of the death of Alexander, that he died a drunk and completely, that is seriously questioned now because of the motive of that biographer who kind of made stuff up, I guess. But he did die at the height of his strength, and his descendants would not inherit his kingdom. There was some question about that, and they were not in a position to take the kingship by force. So historical records say that after Alexander's death, both his sons, Alexander IV and Heracles, were murdered, preventing them from carrying on their legacy. Rather, his empire would be divided into four kingdoms and ruled by four of his generals. The division of this kingdom has been told in 7:6 by the four heads of the leopard, and in 8:8 by the four horns of the goat. These divisions were ruled by Seleucus I, Nicator. I think it means the cigarette smoker. I'm not sure there, but and then Ptolemy I, Soter, which is salvation, savior, Cassander, and Lysimachus. So those were the four generals that took over and began the going the four corners of the globe to divide up the country. It's interesting to me to recognize that world domination back in this time was almost an impossible task. Not domination, conquering would be one thing, but to rule it. I mean, when it took days, weeks, months to travel from one side to the other, how do you keep things under control? You know, you put people in control that you trust and so on, and then they say, what's he going to do, you know? So they walk up to the king and say, we don't want to be friends anymore. And, you know, it's just a tough time. Jim? So, you know, draw a line from one place to the other and then say, one man going 20 miles a day, an army going 10 miles a day. That's a long time. No electronic communication, so all of that made it very difficult. So, it's technology that's going to allow the Antichrist to be able to actually control, rule the world when he ascends to power. All right. So number one, prophecies concerning Persia and Greece. Number two, prophecies concerning Egypt and Syria. Syria is that country just north of Israel. We see, first of all here, the period of Ptolemaic dominance. You saw that the second general I mentioned is named Ptolemy. This refers to his control. This remarkably detailed prophecy of the 150-year struggle between the various inheritors of Alexander's kingdom concentrates on Ptolemy I, Soter, 323 to 283. So you see, this is so many years after Daniel. His successors in Egypt, the kings of the south, Seleucus I, Nicator, and his successors in Syria, the kings of the north. The north-south designation, from the perspective of the geographical area of Israel, rather than mentioning Syria, for example, by name, fits the predictive character of the passage. For Daniel would not have known Syria by that name in his day. So at that time, he says, whatever was going on, whoever was king, whatever they called it in that time. So Ptolemy I, Soter, and Seleucus I, Nicator, the king of the south shall be strong, one of his princes, and he shall be strong above him and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion. So the king of the south, Ptolemy I, Soter, one of Alexander's generals, took control of Egypt. This was a very powerful country, wealthy country. Egypt is a land right in the middle of a desert, but the Nile which flows south to north, goes through all the jungle of Africa, and on in flood season, gathers all that luscious vegetation rot and stuff, and comes up to Egypt, and just spreads it out over the sand as it goes into the Mediterranean Sea. And every year it gave them re-fertilized and organic, organically fertilized fields. Someone said that Egypt was the gift of the Nile. And so it didn't depend on a lot because it was fed by, in fact, the Nile. So it was a real prize to gain. So Ptolemy went there, divided it up there. One of his princes, however, was Seleucus I Nicator, who had been appointed ruler over Babylonia, but who fled to Egypt when Antigonus, another of Alexander's generals, usurped his rule. Under the sponsorship of Ptolemy, Seleucus defeated Antigonus at Gaza, took over the division of Alexander's empire that included Babylonia, Syria, and Media, the largest of the four divisions. They were largest, but not necessarily the wealthiest. Then he mentions Berenice. In the end of years, shall they join themselves together, the Hebrew literally associate themselves, for the king's daughter of the south shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement, to make rights. But she shall not retain the power of the arm, neither shall he stand, nor his arm, but she shall be given up. And they that brought her, and he that begat her, or whom she brought forth, that she begat would be another way of saying it, and he that strengthened her in these times. Now, getting into this is pretty interesting. The 30-year gap between verses 5 and 6, the reign of Antiochus the First Soter is skipped over entirely. Then in verses 6 to 9, the tragic marriage of Berenice, daughter of the king of the south, to the king of the north is spoken of, with some of its evil consequences. Conflicts arose between these two kingdoms from the beginning and continued until the time of Ptolemy II Philadelphus, the lover of brethren. According to tradition, Ptolemy II was the king of the south who instigated the translation of the Hebrew Bible into Greek. Tradition, we don't know that for sure, that's the Septuagint. This translation, properly known as the Septuagint or 70, and usually abbreviated as Roman numerals LXX, based on the reported number of translators involved. In approximately 250 BC, Ptolemy II made a peace treaty with Antiochus II Theos, God, what a nickname, huh? The king of the north and the grandson Seleucus I. Ptolemy sealed the treaty by giving his daughter Berenice in marriage to Antiochus with the understanding that their first male child would take the Seleucid throne. However, Antiochus' first wife, Laodice, plotted against this arrangement and succeeded in murdering Antiochus, Berenice, and their son. This follows the alternate reading at the end of verse 6, which has the one whom she sired rather than the one who begat her. Laodice then took the throne as queen regent, waiting for her own son, Seleucus II, Callinicus, to come of age. So, bedevilment in all of this. We then see Ptolemy III, Euergetes, but out of a branch of her roots shall one stand up in his estate, or in his place, or in his office, which shall come with an army, and shall enter into the fortress of the king of the north, and shall deal against them, and shall prevail, and shall also carry captives into Egypt their gods. Carry into Egypt into captivity their gods, and their with their princes, and with their precious vessels, the Hebrew, the vessels of their desire. of silver and of gold, and he shall continue more years than the king of the north. So the king of the south shall come into his kingdom and shall return into his own land. You know, we were saying earlier that the prophecy of the coming Messiah, I believe, were read by the Magi, the people, the wise men who followed Daniel. Can you imagine them discovering his works, reading through this, checking it with their history books, saying, "Are you kidding me? He knew it all. It was all right there. It's just step by step, all given, you know." Well, so the king of the south will come to his kingdom and shall return into his own land. So out of a branch of her roots refers to the line of Berenice, and specifically to her brother Ptolemy the third, Euergetes, who succeeded his father Ptolemy the second to the throne of Egypt in his father's place. In retaliation for his sister's murder, Ptolemy the third attacked Syria with a large army. After a prolonged conflict, Ptolemy gained a resounding victory over the Syrian forces, put to death the evil Laodice, looted the capital city of Antioch, and brought its treasures back to Egypt. Shall also carry captives into Egypt their gods, the princes, precious vessels. So, literally fulfilled. We see then Laodice's son, Seleucus II, having ruled under the auspices of his mother, attempted to revenge his mother's death, but was unsuccessful. In 240 BC, Ptolemy was able to force Seleucus II into a peace treaty to halt further hostilities between the two. The angel goes on then to speak of Seleucus III, Saronus, and Antiochus III. But his sons shall be stirred up, or could be translated, shall war, and shall assemble a multitude of great forces. And one shall certainly come and overflow and pass through. Then shall he return and be stirred up, or be stirred up again, even to his fortress. And the king of the south shall be moved with choler, shall come forth and fight with him, even with the king of the north. And he shall set forth a great multitude, but the multitude shall be given into his hand. And when he hath taken away the multitude, his heart shall be lifted up, and he shall cast down many 10,000s, but he shall not be strengthened by it. The his sons referred to the two sons of Seleucus II, Seleucus III, Saronus, and Antiochus III, moving there into the 100s BC, as you see. Both of these renewed the conflict with the Ptolemies. Seleucus III was murdered after a three-year reign and was succeeded by his brother Antiochus III. Antiochus III was called the Great because of his military successes, briefly taking control of Phoenicia and Palestine, territories which up to that time had been under Egyptian rule. In response, Ptolemy IV, Philopater, lover of father, the king of the south, raised a massive army and launched a counter-offensive. He gained a great victory over the Syrian forces at Raphia in 217 BC, slaughtering thousands of the enemy troops and regaining control of Phoenicia and Palestine. His heart became filled with pride from his victory, and as a divine judgment, Egyptian dominion of these lands did not continue after his death. Following the death of Ptolemy IV, Antiochus III once again invaded Ptolemaic territories with a sizable force, and by 201 BC was able to regain Phoenicia and Palestine for the Seleucid regime. We come then to the period of Seleucid dominance, with first of all speaking of Antiochus III, for the king of the north shall return and shall set forth a multitude greater than the former, and shall certainly come after certain years, or at the end of times, even years, with a great army and with much riches. And in those times there shall be many, there shall many stand up against the king of the south. Also the robbers, literally the children of robbers, of thy people shall exalt themselves to establish the vision, but they shall fall. So the king of the north shall come, cast up a mount, and take the most fenced cities, the city of munitions. The arms of the south shall not withstand, neither his chosen people, the people of his choices. Neither shall there be any strength to withstand, but he that cometh against him shall do according to his own will, and none shall stand before him. He shall stand in the glorious land, or the goodly land, the Hebrew, the land of ornament, which by his hand shall be consumed. So what this is talking about, the king of the south is Ptolemy the fifth, Epiphanes, the son of Ptolemy the fourth, the many who opposed him included Antiochus the third, his ally Philip the fifth of Macedon, a number of Jews who sided with Antiochus the third to establish the vision. The vision these individuals establish is Daniel's prophetic vision related to these verses. What this means is that they do what establishes this vision as the truth. General Scopas and the Egyptian army were ultimately defeated by the Syrian army, but in their retreat, they killed a number of the Jewish leaders and others who fought with the Syrians. So this is the glorious land, the land of ornament, which is the Holy Land. Having been turned back by the Syrian forces in the Battle of Panium in 199, the Egyptian army sought refuge in Sidon, but to no avail. The Syrian forces laid siege to Sidon. You've heard of Tyre and Sidon, the Gentile cities there in the Holy Land. And in 196 BC, the Egyptians were forced to surrender. With the defeat of the Egyptians, Antiochus III had complete control over Phoenicia and all of the Holy Land there, the glorious land, the goodly land, land of ornament. And as a warning to those who would oppose him, slew the Jews who had sided with the Egyptians. Tough time for the Jews. Now we come to, and amazing to us who know the name Cleopatra, Antiochus III and Cleopatra. He shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom and upright ones, or much uprightness, or equal conditions, with him. Thus shall he do, and he shall give him the daughter of women, corrupting, the purpose to corrupt her, but she shall not stand on his side, neither be for him. So following their victory, the Syrians forced the Egyptians into a peace treaty. Antiochus III giving his daughter, Cleopatra, to Ptolemy V to be his wife. So she was not Egyptian, she was transferred to Egypt. Antiochus had hoped his daughter would be an ally in his desire to expand his dominion further south. However, she became loyal to her husband. Who would have guessed? And Ptolemaic interests and thwarted her father's plans. So the place in the Bible where Cleopatra shows up. The end of Antiochus, I've searched and I can't find Richard Burton anywhere. I don't know, but at the end of Antiochus III, after this shall he turn his face unto the isles and shall take many, but a prince for his own behalf or for him shall cause the reproach, his reproach offered by him to cease. Without his own reproach, he shall cause it to turn upon him. Then he shall turn his face toward the fort of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and not be found. Then shall stand up in his estate or place a raiser of taxes, one that causeth an exactor to pass over, in the glory of the kingdom. But within few days he shall be destroyed, neither in anger nor in battle. So frustrated in his ambitions to the south, Antiochus turned his attention to the west. After some initial successes, he was soundly defeated by a coalition of Romans and Greeks at Thermopylae in 191 BC and was forced to retreat. The Roman army pursued the Syrians into Asia Minor, routed the much larger Syrian forces at Magnesia, known for its milk, I think, is it? In 190, and left Antiochus with no choice but to surrender. In 188, BC, the Romans compelled Antiochus to sign the Treaty of Apamea. In connection with this, Antiochus was required to give up territories in the west, divest himself of much of his army, pay heavy indemnity to Rome, and forced to hand over hostages, including one of his sons, Antiochus IV, Epiphanes. So we're sort of introduced to this character by understanding the history, that he was sent to Rome. After returning home, Antiochus III was slain by an angry mob when he attempted to pillage a temple of Zeus in Elymais. His ill-fated effort was to pay the heavy tribute Rome demanded annually as part of his treaty. He needed money, so he went after the temple. We see this beginning to go on in our America today. Go after the tax-free people. His eldest son, Seleucus IV, Philopater, succeeded him to the throne, still faced with heavy tribute forced on him by Rome. Seleucus sent his prime minister, Heliodorus, into Palestine to plunder the treasuries in Jerusalem, called the glory of the jewel of the kingdom. The Lord intervened, however, and after a frightful vision of mighty angels, Heliodorus was deterred from carrying out his mission. God just scared him away. Seleucus IV reigned for only a short period before he was poisoned by Heliodorus and died an ignominious death, not in anger or in battle, just a political advancement. Heliodorus evidently was motivated by his own ambitions, perhaps with the encouragement of Antiochus IV, the younger brother of Seleucus, who coveted his older brother's throne. So we'll stop there and look at what other historical events are given next time. But to just stop and think, all of this detailed thing, we on this side of history can go to the history books and say this matches up exactly. Nothing he said was wrong. Everything he said is accounted for. And again, for you and I as Baptists to look at these things and say, let's let the Bible mean what it says. Everything that was prophesied was fulfilled literally, not symbolically, not generically, not in somebody's thoughts, but actual fulfillment. Comments or questions? All right. Well, let's stand together and we'll be dismissed in prayer. Father, you've given us an opportunity to see how you show yourself to be the God that lives in eternity, outside of time. We ask, Father, that you might help us to recognize that when you speak of the things of the future, this isn't a shrewd guess, this isn't an estimate. You see the future as we might see the past, as something that has been accomplished. To you, it's all before you, as though written out. We know, Father, that you can then specify in detail the things that will happen, and we can base our faith and our lives on the fact that it is true. So guide and direct us then to build our understanding and our faith in your word. And we pray it in Jesus' name. Amen.